roaring sound. That's what I remember most. The tremendous roar and crackling as the flames raced through the trees and into the town. What I remember next is the faces. Especially the faces of those gathered at the pub whose loved ones were missing and feared lost.
These are the words from a story by Jim Williamson, a young forester who was in dwelling up on the night of Tuesday the 24th of January 1961, the night that dwelling up and two other nearby towns were burnt to the ground and over a million acres of forest and farmland were incinerated. It was Western Australia's worst bushfire disaster. What happened? First, southwest forests were ill prepared for fire. Government policy had seen almost no fuel reduction burning for several decades, and the bush was carrying heavy fuels. Second, there was shocking weather. In the period January to March of 1961, the southwest of WA experienced a succession of ugly weather events, each one typical of that most feared phenomenon for West Australian firefighters. A large high-pressure system, stationary in the Great Australian Bight, drawing hot, dry winds from the interior into the southwest, plus a cyclone off the Pilbara coast. The two interacting weather systems produced powerful winds and atmospheric instability with dry thunderstorms and lightning. In most summers, these conditions might occur only once, but during the 1960-61 summer, they occurred three times, each time resulting in heat waves, lightning storms, and savage bushfires. Thus, the firefighters of 1961 were confronted with the worst possible combination of events. Many fires started more or less simultaneously, burning in heavy fuels under extreme weather conditions. The situation was well described in the subsequent report of the Royal Commission.
Hot, humid, rainless conditions culminated on the 19th of January when severe electrical storms produced a series of lightning fires extending from Mundaring in the north to Manjum up in the south, to be followed by further severe dry thunderstorms and lightning fires the following evening. The fires thus started burnt under continuing heatwave conditions for the next 5 days, and a disastrous blow-up occurred on the evening of the 24th of January when cyclonic winds associated with the southern movement of a tropical cyclone struck miles of partially controlled and uncontrolled fires. Heavy destruction of forest land and property resulted.
The bald and dry reporting of the Royal Commissioner is to be expected in an official document, but it fails to convey the drama and tragedy of events. For this, we must turn to the voices of the firefighters and the survivors, the people who were at the front at the time. Frank Campbell was the DFO, or officer in charge of the Forest Department's district headquarters at Dwelling Up at that time. In this position, he was responsible for bushfire control over the hundreds of thousands of acres of Jarrah forests around Dwelling Up. He recalls...
Well, I was in the forestry office with my senior staff on the Thursdays the fires started. We all knew there was going to be trouble. The first lightning storm came through late in the afternoon, and Albert Kalnins, the lookout man at Mount Wells Tower, began to phone through the lightning strikes. We mobilised the gangs and officers right from this point. From 6:30 p.m, we'd plotted six separate fires in the Dwelling Up Forest. They were burning in heavy fuels under hot and windy conditions. Every officer and firefighter we dispatched did a wonderful job. By early the next morning, all but one of the fires had been stopped, but there was a big mop-up ahead of us to make the fires safe.
Then came the kicker. The lookout towers were manned from before dawn on Friday morning. Frank Campbell goes on.
Well, as soon as the towers were up at first light, four new fires from the previous night's lightning storm were identified. The temperatures that day reached 41, and we all knew we had a cruel day ahead of us.
Des Donnelly was a cadet forester and a member of Jimmy Warren's forestry gang at that time. He was one of those who worked all through that first night. In the late afternoon of day one, the crew had been dispatched to a smoke deep in the forest, east of Dirlingup. Des recalls,
"The fire was confined to the topmost branches of a very large jarrah tree which had been struck by a bolt of lightning. A shower of rain had dampened the bush and prevented spot fires from starting at the foot of the tree. We walked in, carrying our gear, and found the tree. By this time, it was almost dark. We did not have a chainsaw, and so we had to fell the tree with axes and a crosscut saw. While two of us worked on scarfing the tree with axes and then backing it down with the crosscut, the others raked a fire trail around the area immediately surrounding the tree. The bush had dried out, and spot fires were beginning to take hold. Finally, we got the tree on the ground and were able to burn out the area within the rake trail. While this was going on, our overseer, Jimmy, made a radio call to HQ. He was told to pack up immediately and head to a running fire on North East Road. We arrived at the fire about 1 o'clock in the morning and proceeded to carry out the standard attack, starting on the head fire and working back around the flanks. It was ironstone country and hard going, but we managed to get a raked trail around the fire by daybreak and stop the running fire."
Normally in those days, when a forestry district had a bad hit with lightning fires like this, gangs and officers would stream in from the neighbouring districts to relieve the crews that had been out all night and to complete the mopping up. This time, no help was available for the dwelling up crews. The lightning storm had run right down the Jarrah Forest, starting numerous fires in the Mundaring, Jarrahdale, Harvey, Collie and Manjimup districts, and everyone had their hands full. There was no system of statewide backup at that time. The dwelling up forestry crews were on their own. But as so often happened in those circumstances and at those times, the Forest Department turned to the timber industry. There was a massive call-up of timber workers to work on the fires. The sawmills at Bankshiredale, Nangarbrook, Chidora, Whittaker's and Dwellingup all came to a halt, and mill and bush crews were placed under the control of the Forest Department. Timber worker Don Devlin was one of those drafted in as a firefighter.
In 1961, I was living in Holyoke. A usual thing in those days was to go to the picture show in the town hall in Dwellingup on a Friday night. On this Friday night, I was standing in line to buy tickets with my wife Judy when a young forestry officer came along. All the young able-bodied men were pulled out of the line, told to go home and cut a crib and report to the forestry office in half an hour. We would be going to a fire. And I got the idea that things were fairly desperate. The forestry had more fires to fight than men to fight them.
Frank Campbell's story continues.
So by about midday on the Friday, we were in serious difficulties. All crews were committed at fires east and north of Dwellingup. Then at 1:15 p.m. we got a report of a new fire northwest of Dwellingup. The only people I had left to send to this fire were Gordon Stiles, a young forest ranger, and old Alf Passmore, the mill overseer. They were armed with pack sprays and rakes and an old jeep with a light pump on the back. By the time they got to it, this fire was already unstoppable. This is the fire that became known as the Torrens Fire, and it was the fire that eventually took out Dwellingup. It had been started by the first lightning storm on the Thursday evening, but had lain dormant for nearly 12 hours before, well, getting up and starting to run.
But worse was to come. Frank Campbell goes on.
So at about 9 p.m. on the second day of the fires, a second massive lightning storm came through the Jarrah Forest. Now, there was a real feeling, there was serious anxiety amongst the foresters in the dwelling up office. Four new fires were detected between 9:55 p.m. and 11 p.m. that night, and between 9:30 a.m. and 11 a.m. on the Saturday morning, another four new fires were reported. The temperature that day reached 40 degrees, and there were strong, swirling winds. Fire behaviour was erratic and extreme. In the office, we were trying to do an impossible juggling act. Crews would be shifted from a fire that was deemed relatively safe to one of the new fires. Then we'd get a report of a danger spot somewhere else, and new arrangements would have to be made.
I've been in situations like this when I was a Forest Department DFO. I can easily imagine the scene in the dwelling up office. The tension and fears, the poring over of maps, the telephone bells jangling, the radio crackling, the coming and going of exhausted officers, a stream of reports of new fires coming in from the lookout towers, but a pervading but unspoken feeling of dread. But I was never in the position Frank Campbell and his colleagues found themselves in at Dwelling Up on the Tuesday of the fires. There had been fires successive days of temperatures above or around 40 degrees. The firefighters were close to exhaustion and were thin spread across a vast sea of burning forests. Then, at this moment, the cyclone up in the Pilbara made its move. It roared south. Cyclonic winds hit the Jarrah Forest, and here they struck the miles of uncontained fire edge north and east of Dwelling Up. Everything unravelled. By then, the tough and experienced forester Bruce Beggs had arrived in Dwelling Up to relieve Frank Campbell. Beggs realised that any further attempt to fight the fires in the bush was hopeless, and that townsite protection must become the priority. By mid-afternoon on the Tuesday, he had issued a recall to all the firefighters to return to Dwelling Up. He had also ensured that the bush townships of Holyoke, Nangarbrook and Bankshiredale were all evacuated. He had forest officers scouring the neighbouring farms and moving from house to house around the Dwelling Up townsite, telling residents to prepare for the worst. Families started to move to the football ground, to shelter in cars, or to gather at the pub. Forest Ranger Ted Cracknell recalled his final inspection at Holyoke on the Tuesday afternoon.
Bruce Beggs instructed me to go out to Holyoke and make sure nobody was left there. He said that the order to evacuate had already been given, but he wanted another check. I drove straight out to Holyoke and circled the town. The place appeared to be deserted. I stopped to check one house, and then, just as I was about to leave, I heard an eerie noise. I thought it was the scream of a child, a terrible call for help. It was coming from the house next door. Could it be a child left behind? Surely not. And yet I had to check. It was not a child, but a Major Mitchell cockatoo in a cage, very frightened and upset. I picked up the cage and plopped him in the back of my ute. I drove back to Dwelling Up and handed him over to my wife.
Dave Joynson was also in Holyoke at about this time.
I thought I'd slip back to Holyoke and try and pick up a few belongings from Mum and Dad's place and from my sister Tuppy's place. I went into the house and noticed their birds in the big cage at the back, so I undid the cage door so they could escape. They'd lived in the cage all their lives and wouldn't leave it, even when I tried to shoo them out. By this time, the fire had almost reached the town. I knew I'd better get going or I'd get caught. Didn't have time to pick up anything. In the main street of Holyoke, I came across an old couple who'd been trying to evacuate, but their car had broken down. The old lady was pleading, but the old man wouldn't leave his car. I was forced to physically manhandle him into my car. I couldn't get back to Dwelling Up on the back road. The fire was already through there, so I had to go out to the main road to the bitumen and round past the cemetery. The fire was pretty much right on us by then. Suddenly, a huge kangaroo leapt out of the bush onto the road in front of us. He was burning, poor bugger. Smoke coming from his fur. He was in front of me and wouldn't get off the road. I reckon I was doing 80 k's an hour. I wasn't gaining on him. Just before we got to the Maradong Road, he tore off into the bush. I'll never forget that poor route.